everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures and puts them in everyday terms and everyday language for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're jumping into a Massachusetts murder case that's drawn national attention. 45-year-old Karen Reed is accused of hitting her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, who happened to be a Boston police officer, hitting him with her SUV and leaving him by the side of the road to die in a snowstorm blizzard. Now, there's already been a hung jury on the first trial of this. That hung jury came back in July, but we've just now started trial number two, and it gives us an opportunity to go through some legal procedures in a highly interesting case and try to decipher some of this for you. I should say also that the Reed case has just recently been the subject of a five-part documentary on Max called A Body in the Snow, The Trial of Karen Reed. Judge Gail, you've been on Court TV over the years talking about this case. Before we get into the mechanics of it, this has just been a highly sensitive case. We've got a 45-year-old woman. We've got a cop boyfriend, accusations of her being framed. There's just been all kinds of things involved in this case.
Yes, that's an understatement. And you are right. I have... and I still do provide commentary to Court TV on various cases. And I recall at the height of the first case, and as this one was being watched very closely nationally and even internationally, that this case drew an awful lot of attention for a lot of the reasons you outlined. The fact that, Karen Reed is considered a fairly young, maybe even attractive defendant who was dating this police officer, John O'Keefe, Boston police officer. It was alleged that their relationship certainly had some elements of toxicity. And so, far from being perfect, no Warden June Cleaver here.
But I think
one of the most interesting things, aside from, the allegations and the surrounding circumstances of the case, is the fact that the community in this area has been so polarized over their feelings. I mean, to the point where you didn't even have sort of the normal, observers for court proceedings. Protesters that were joining
every day.
I recall one guy being coined Turtle Man or Turtle Boy
we'll get to Turtle Boy.
Yes, Turtle Boy. And I only say that, but yes, we can get to the more specifics of it. But I mean, leading all out charges to vindicate Karen Reed, which goes to the point of and the concern, I think, that any defendant and any prosecutor would have with regard to picking and selecting a jury that is objective and not shaded. It's almost, it's very difficult, I would think, given the close-knit community this is in. Pretty difficult to find anybody who hasn't heard about this case and possibly hasn't formed some kind of opinion. Although I think, there's still been successes the second time around in picking a jury, but my goodness, boy, are there opinions on both sides.
Yeah. So let's sort of go through some of the facts. Like I said, the first case had 70 different witnesses. And the prosecution's theory is that the couple was out drinking with a bunch of other police officers and their spouses and girlfriends, and they were to go to a particular house for sort of an after party. They pull up in front of the house. The house is dark. The police officer, John O'Keefe, was going to go up to the door to see if they still wanted people to arrive. He never returned, never communicated again with Karen Reed, who was driving the vehicle. So she gets upset. She starts making all of these calls to him, really nasty calls, and leaves.
I think nasty's a relative. Have you ever had a lover who hasn't responded to your call these day and ages when there's so many ways to connect with somebody?
I know, nasty, but well, let's just use nasty. I mean, they were really vicious.
But we'll just say, you'll trade vicious for nasty. Okay, they're not nasty. They're vicious and maniacal. Go with that.
Well, I'm looking at it as a defense attorney, and you know, I wouldn't have wanted these played. Let me just say that. They were not favorable to Karen Reed. However, the prosecution claims that she hit him. She backed her car into him at 24 miles an hour, knocked him down. He had a skull fracture, and he wandered around and fell on the ground in a blizzard, I mean, a absolute blizzard, and died of exposure. Now, that's the prosecution's theory. The defense theory was that she was framed, that he actually went into the house, had marks on his arm that resembled, according to their experts, dog bites, and that the owner, one of the owners of the house, the woman owner of the house, texted on her phone, or did a Google search, I should say, not texting.
I think this is the how long it takes to die in the snow.
How long does it take to die in the snow? Mm-hmm. So that plus the lead investigator for the state was caught making sexual references about Karen Reed on his cell phone to other members of the investigative team. You know, is she hot? Oh, yeah, she's hot, and plus more. Yeah, I'm
classy. I'm just giving, classy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's so repulsive. So let's find a word to describe that. That's repulsive.
It's not vicious, but it's gaggy. How's gaggy as opposed to repulsive?
Let's go with repulsive. Those are still objectifying statements about a woman that are unwarranted. So
that's true. So all right. So all of this happened. She's charged with three charges: second-degree murder, leaving the scene of an accident, manslaughter while operating under the influence. The trial was this past summer. The prosecutor in the case, if you watch the documentary, and by the way, her name is spelled R-E-A-D, just like Reed, as opposed to normal Reed, which might be R-E-I-D. This is R-E-A-D, so if you're Googling her and want to look her up, it's Karen Reed, R-E-A-D.
Although I'll tell you, if you're Googling her, and even if you spell it wrong, AI is so sharp, they'll know what case you're talking about. And they'll just correct that spelling for you and get you right over to what you're looking for.
Well, they showed the prosecutor in this case, and I'm telling you, Judge Gale, I don't know whether in your analysis you got to see him, but one of the reporters covering the case from Boston said that watching this prosecutor was like watching oatmeal.
Oh, not paint dry.
Just watching a bowl of oatmeal.
Oh, that's terrible.
He had no flair, no class, just bombarded the jury with names and facts and situations. In other words, he took a broad approach to the case instead of a very narrow one. And some of the critics say that's why he lost the case. But he was just horrible.
So, Judge, here's what I think. I think you would agree that winning any case is a combination of things. That's why I think any good prosecutor and any good lawyer need not ever go to acting class, because if you're really good at it, it actually comes pretty natural. And you could probably, you know, you've probably given some Oscar-worthy performances, depending.
No, I'm telling you, let me just interrupt real quick. You know, I'll toss it back to you. I've always said being a trial lawyer is three parts. One part lawyer, you got to know the law. One part thespian, you have to know how to act. Mm-hmm. And the other part is being a thug street fighter. You got to know when to sucker punch and when to run.
Yeah, when to duck and move.
That's right.
And when to jab. You are absolutely right. And so when the prosecutor, who, by the way, as if you've listened to our prior episodes, we've told you about the responsibility of the prosecutor who has the burden of proof, the prosecutor who often speaks first and speaks last because of this heightened burden of proof, the prosecutor who will have the duty of convincing the jury or the judge, whoever the trier of fact is, of the not just the veracity or the evidence supporting their case, but to the highest degree that our justice system recognizes, beyond a reasonable doubt. And so, yes, it is important to present facts. I think you and I can both agree. We both had those cases where we know some part of it is maybe it's going to be medical or it's going to be scientific, right. And you're probably going to lose the attention span of your jurors or your jury or your judge somewhere through there.
You've got to punch it up. You've either got to have something big at the beginning.
Yes.
Or at the end, or hopefully both, because the middle is going to be lost.
It's going to be hard. And even in presenting that scientific evidence, you now have to kind of use whatever tools are at your disposal to make sure that you maintain or retain as much attention as you can, which is why demonstrative evidence or, you know, presentation assistance are so very important. That can be, you know, boards, whiteboards, it can be videos, it can be, you know, anything that brings the witness out of the witness stand to help demonstrate something, even though you know, again, that the information is highly technical and it is scientific, right. And most people can't wrap their minds around it. If you are describing the prosecutor's presentation as oatmeal, or in the words of one of my favorite now retired judges who I used to work with when I was a baby prosecutor, Judge Janet Burnside, she would call you a potted plant. If this is, if you are there, yeah. And you are a potted plant, this is probably one of the greatest disservices you could give to a case, especially because, yes, you really do want the trier of fact to listen to the facts, but also it's about appreciating how they're presented. It's like food, right? We eat with our eyes first. You may have a wonderfully cooked meal and it may taste just amazing, but if it looks terrible, you're never going to even give it a try. And if you are,
if it's brown and blah, yeah, you're not going to eat it.
And it doesn't matter how wonderful it tastes. It may actually taste really well, but you're never going to even get a spoon picked up off the plate to give it a try because you can't even get past how it looks. If that's what the prosecutor's doing.
That analogy reminds me of my mother's bad cooking.
Oh, no. My mom was from the South, so she was actually a fantastic cook, which is why I still struggle with my weight in adulthood.
my mother would take a pot roast and somehow put it through some process where it came out dry, so brown that it was gray with tinges of green.
Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord.
So, it was like leather. So you're right. You have to have an appeal to get people interested.
You need a spunk.
Whether it's food or whether it's evidence.
Oatmeal. I'm going to keep that one. Oatmeal.
Yeah. The reporter said it was like just watching a bowl of oatmeal. Anyway, the jury deliberated for 3 days on that first trial. And on July 1, same day that we got the Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity, the jury came back and after multiple times, finally came back and said, hey, we're hopelessly deadlocked. And the judge ordered a mistrial, which we've talked about. A jury's verdict has to be unanimous. It wasn't. So the judge ordered a mistrial, which has allowed the prosecution to come back and try trial number two. The prosecution has said, we're going to try this as long as it takes to get a conviction.
And if I can jump in just really quickly, what you just said was so important for our listeners to understand. It is the fact that the jury actually heard the evidence, they heard the information, they received the law and the instructions from the court, and they deliberated, meaning they considered everything, they followed the instructions the court gave them, and they were still unable to reach a unanimous verdict as to any of the charges. And they did not return a unanimous verdict. And because they did not and could not return a unanimous verdict, the court issued the mistrial, which preserved the right for the prosecution to retry the case. I know some people are thinking, well, why is that not double jeopardy? What do you mean? They get to come back and they get to do it again. Double jeopardy would have only attached if, in fact, there had been a verdict that was issued. And in this instance, there was a mistrial. So the mistrial actually keeps essentially the case alive for the prosecution, which is why they can make the commitment that Judge Tom just said, in that they have committed that they're going to keep trying this case until they get an actual verdict. And they did not get an actual verdict, although there is some argument, as I understand it, as to whether or not the jury actually reached a unanimous verdict, but just failed to sign the jury forms or the verdict forms to that effect, or if they understood those instructions. I think that's an issue that went up on appeal and it was unsuccessful and all the charges are still alive.
Let me jump in and clarify that point so we don't confuse our listeners. You're right. The defense team for Karen Reed has now asked the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case on this point. The defense team has found that the original jury, the one back in July, did find unanimous not guilty verdicts on the second degree murder charge and on the leaving the scene of the accident charge. There was no unanimous verdict on the manslaughter charge. But when they sent the note to the judge and told the judge that they couldn't arrive at a unanimous verdict, the judge assumed that meant on all three cases. Well, the defense is saying they really did decide two of the cases unanimously. You should have asked them whether they were undecided on all three or not, and they would have said, well, we've got two of them that we've decided. Well, that appeal went to the trial judge. No, didn't fly. It went to the intermediate level appellate court in Massachusetts, didn't fly. Went to the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, didn't fly. They took it to the federal court, federal district court, didn't fly. Went to the federal appellate court, that didn't fly. But now they have just asked the U.S. Supreme Court to take jurisdiction over this matter and decide it. I think it's obviously a long shot, but an interesting concept.
Indeed it is. But I think, again, given the consistency of all of the lower court rulings, I think it should be understood that you're right. A, this is a long shot, but even inside of all of this, so this is what's interesting to me, is on that first jury, there were actual attorneys. I don't know why a defense attorney or a prosecutor would leave a lawyer on the jury. I got called for jury duty twice, and I knew that despite having practiced a speech like it was Easter in a Black Baptist church and I was 7 years old, that no delivery of that speech was going to land me as a juror in any of these cases. This was
I've always wanted to be a juror.
Oh my gosh. I think I'm one of the few people who did the happy dance when I got the summons, because jury duty is something I've wanted to do. And I knew I would likely never have an opportunity to truly fulfill the obligation and the mission of jury duty. But that said, they left an attorney on that first jury. It's an attorney that is now, I think, has joined the defense team of Karen Reed's now second trial.
Let me jump in to be totally accurate.
It was an alternate juror.
It was an alternate juror who did not participate in the deliberation.
Correct. A non-deliberating alternate juror.
A woman by the name of Victoria George.
Indeed.
And she's been now added to the defense attorney.
She's now part of the defense team. And so the question—
How crazy is that?
It is absolutely, that's bonkers and bananas. But again, the question, I think, as it relates to this issue of as to whether or not the jury actually found the defendant not guilty on those charges you've identified, the second-degree murder and the leaving the scene of an accident, the question becomes, you know, what is the duty of the court to inquire more specifically as to what the intent of the jury is when they send back a communication while they're deliberating? Because you're right, there are assumptions that are embedded in it, and we don't even recognize those things as assumptions. You know, as judges, and quite frankly, my practice was anytime there was a query from a jury, I would always share that with both the prosecution and the defense.
Oh,
they
I
had
would
a right
too.
To know what the jury was asking and where the jury was with regard to deliberations. And I also would share with the prosecution and the defense my response to the jury so that they would be aware of how I have responded. If that is in fact the case, then again, yes, the ultimate responsibility falls to the judge. But in reviewing such a statement from the jury with the prosecution and the defense, it also appears that at least everyone, both the prosecution and the defense, along with the judge, they all assume the same thing. They all assume that the jury was speaking to all of the charges in the case and not that they were, you know, only unable to reach a verdict as to one of the three charges. So no one seemingly from the prosecution or no one from the defense sought to or thought to even, you know, tell the judge or ask the judge if they would be willing or interested in responding to the jury by asking them specifically if their inability to reach a verdict was related to all charges, some charges, no charges. That may have cured it then.
But I think it's a long shot now, and I think the second trial is going to go on. So let me preface this, because I want to ask you some real quick questions, like in real quick order. So would you agree with me, second trials are more difficult than the first?
Yes.
And my reasoning for that is, as the attorney, you've already been through it. There are few surprises. You're not as sharp. You can't always remember, was that said at the first trial? Was that said at the second trial? I mean, I just think it is, you're just not as sharp on either side. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there are also ways to navigate that, though, because remember, the transcript from the first trial is available. Sure. And if you have a robust enough team, then you could have, if you have the resources and your team is robust enough, so these are a lot of ifs, you can invest in the transcript. But in addition to that, you can assign the responsibility to someone on your team to kind of track the testimony and the process from the first case. Because what you want to do is, you as a prosecutor, I would want to identify where the failings were. Like, where did we really, really lose them? Because our burden is really high. So debrief the jury, but also kind of figure out, hey, where did we lose them? If you know that, gosh, you know what, we're going to have to retry this whole case, even though I know that I had, if I didn't have all of them, I had most of these jurors ready to acquit on these charges, then that means I was really coming up short on evidence. So I was really not, you know, bringing these points home in order to match the facts to the evidence to get them to understand that this is how this case is proven. So, well, I think that deserves some more introspection.
I think the new prosecutor, special prosecutor, a guy by the name of Hank Brennan, it did
pancakes. Is he pancakes and not oatmeal?
he's much better. He's got a great reputation, actually. He's been on both sides of the fence as a defense attorney and a prosecutor. So he knows the courtroom very well. But I think he did exactly what you talked about, Judge Gale, and that is, he looked at the case and he said, you know, the first time we presented this as the government, it was way too confusing. We tried to get too much in there. We're going to streamline the case to make it easier to understand. You know, that is an advantage for the prosecution, I think, in a second trial.
I absolutely agree. Here's also a bit of an anomaly. My experience has been, traditionally, whoever tries it the first time tries it the second time. And so I don't think that maybe it was the reporter who had any influence over who would be the new prosecutor, but good for them in putting some new eyes on this case and taking a totally different approach. Because you're right, if you're the same prosecutor who tried it the first time, you may very well have on the beer goggles. You may not be able to have seen where some of the blaring errors were, and you may still be pining over rulings on objections that you didn't disagree with the court. So that can really short circuit your ability to take a fresh approach to it. And again, streamline it so that the next set of jurors that you pick can really truly understand it. And I suspect, and I am trying to recall this, one thing I found as a really good technique when I was a litigator is I would make cases kind of make sense to my jury very early on. And so you sometimes do that by building a theme, or you tell them a story, or you, again, you start painting a picture. You make things kind of connect very early on so that you bring them along on this journey. And at the end of the journey, they ultimately arrive at the same point that you arrive at, which is hopefully the conviction if you're the prosecution, or it's the acquittal if you're the defense. If you're retrying a case and you're meandering everybody down the same path that you were down before, then you're probably going to end up at the same destination you were before, which is, you know, a hung jury or maybe a flat out acquittal, because this jury is going to get it right and be sure to return the not guilties on at least some of the charges.
Now, let's look at the opposite side of this coin. From all that I've read and all that I've heard, in you know, being in Plymouth here, Plymouth, Massachusetts, I'm close to this area, so I get a lot of the local newscasts.
Lucky you.
The defense had a 2-day presentation of evidence in the first trial. And they brought in certain experts, telephone experts and medical experts, et cetera. This time, the defense is claiming that they will present evidence for 2 weeks, not 2 days, because they know everything that the prosecution is going to put out, and they are now prepared to bring in experts. You know, does that run the danger of overkill? If you've got a prosecution that's streamlining the case and the defense who is elongating the case, what do you think?
That's a really interesting tactic that may or may not work to the defendant's benefit. It may be that in reflecting on the case, it at least appears that the defense did enough with regard to two of the charges in the case to warrant an acquittal. It seems like as to that third charge, that manslaughter charge, there may have still been a hung jury. And therefore, that charge may have still just been hanging out there no matter what. If the goal, perhaps, of the defense is, listen, we pretty much have the solid facts, witnesses, case, evidence, everything we need to recreate what we did before with regard to the second degree murder and the leaving the scene of the accident charges, we've got that. But what we want is our client completely over the finish line in this case, entirely behind her with an absolute vindication. Then we didn't do our jobs the first time around because we left that very serious charge still there with the jury wondering, maybe, maybe not. So we have to bolster what we present to ensure that just as we got the jury to those unsigned verdicts on those other two charges, we're going to get them to sign those verdicts this time, but this time we're also going to get them to sign the not guilty on the manslaughter. So I think that definitely takes a different kind of calculus. Yeah, I think obviously their strategy and their contemplation of this case is different from that of the prosecution, who, as you said, seeks to streamline it. And quite frankly, the defense likely benefited from the prosecution's overly robust, overly complicated.
Oh, it did. It was so confusing.
That had no through lines.
Yeah. No through line. Mm-hmm. Just a bunch of names, bunch of facts, bunch of little pieces of evidence that did not have a lot of connectivity.
Exactly. And so that disjointedness actually allow the defense kind of to sit back and do nothing. And again, let me be clear. The defense has no obligation to put forward a case. When I was on the bench, I would frequently tell defendants, hey, listen, this responsibility rests solely, squarely, and exclusively with the state. They have the sole burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. If you want to sit there and write out your grocery list, if you want to play tic-tac-toe with your lawyer, you want to come paint by numbers, you know, whatever you want to do, you are welcome to do. You can take a nap if you want to, because at the end of the day, that's
Trump
not
did.
Your responsibility. But right. We've seen defendants actually do that, even when the stakes are pretty high.
I had a person charged with capital murder, a death penalty case, and he fell asleep at his own trial.
Those
are
head scratchers,
but it's just sometimes some parts of trials are just so boring you can't help it. You know?
Yes, and there is necessary. So you have to do it. You have to get through it. They're elemental. You will otherwise, you know, face real challenges, perhaps on appeal, even if not during the trial itself. So you definitely have to make sure that that part is done. So I guess I get it. And also remember, most people just aren't used to spending hours on end in a courtroom, especially if you don't have a speaking part or a presenting part. It's not always so mentally stimulating. So being a passive listener is good for a while, but for long stretches of time where you're expected to focus and listen to some people who just like the sound of their voice, the nerve of us, since we're doing a podcast, but the truth is some people are like that, and that can be really difficult to be on the receiving end of that. That said, again, I think this is all strategy on the part of both the prosecution and the defense. The prosecution has decided the defense will not benefit from them having a disjointed presentation that lacks focus, strategy, through lines, thematic overlays and the like. And the defense has said, hey, listen, you know what? You guys gave us a gift before. We're going to try to repackage that gift and make it stick this time. But at the same time, we're also going to try to make sure we get all of these serious charges, not just dismissed, but acquitted. We want our client acquitted of all of this. And so, yeah, we're going to present even more so we can get that over the finish line.
Okay, I want to move on now to two witnesses. We've talked about sort of prosecution defense strategy. Two witnesses that may be different this time. Michael Proctor, the Massachusetts State Police officer who was the lead investigator in the case that we talked about earlier in this podcast, sending degrading text messages about Karen Reed to his colleagues during the investigation.
Degrading's nice. I said repulsive, but go with that.
Degrading. but he was fired by the Massachusetts State Police for doing that. He's been fired after the hung jury and before trial number two. Now, he's on witness list by both the prosecution and the defense. If you're a prosecutor and you've got a witness who has been fired because of, you know, unprofessional conduct while conducting a murder investigation, one, would you put him on? Two, would you put him on first as opposed to last? Or three, would you just let the defense bring him on as a hostile witness?
So,
easy question.
I'm going to ask you the same question for purposes of being a defense attorney, but okay. I will tell you, as a prosecutor, it depends.
He's lead investigator.
Yeah, it depends on how desperately I need this testimony. And it appears that you really do need the testimony, the substance of it. And so I would absolutely put him on, but I would put him on in a very strategic way. Let me explain what that means. I would, first of all, put him on first because I adhere to what I call the rules of primacy and recency.
Yes.
And so I need him up. I need him substantively testifying, and I need him gone. And I need for the memory of his testimony to be fairly faded by the time this is over. But there's important information that I can likely only get out through him. Now, he's also a very flawed witness. Maybe the Michael Cohen
That's a good analogy. Good analogy.
He's a very flawed witness. And so in so doing, you also don't hide from the flaw. In fact, you highlight the flaw. Make that one of the first things you bring out. I call that the Band-Aid theory. You ever had a Band-Aid as a kid and you know, after it's been on for a while, you're like, okay, you know, do I keep it on? Do I take it off? Okay, I'm going to take it off. Okay, how do I take it off? Do I take it off slowly? Because I just don't like the pain. And so it's only going to sting a little bit, thereby just making it a long, drawn out process that actually hurts more. Or do you just rip it off, experience the sting, and discard it? And I am a real proponent of the latter as opposed to the former. You rip it off. You rip it off, you expose, you deal with the sting, and you move on. In this instance, the sting is the fact that as the lead detective, he was actually fired. He was fired for making comments, yes, about the defendant, but I would make the distinction that the comments made about the defendant were not related to the substantive nature of the investigation. Those things need to be made very distinct for the jury. At the same time, yes, tell the jury, yes, the witness is a pig. The witness is imperfect. The witness has made repulsive statements. The witness has absolutely, you know, not perfectly honored their oath as an officer and has been punished for that. And their punishment is probably one of the most severe forms of punishment. They've been separated from the force. They were fired. And for somebody who's committed their life to public service, that is a huge gut punch. Now that we've got that set aside, let's talk about the substance of what happened, because one does not have to affect the other. And I would walk the jury through those distinctions and rob the defense of the opportunity to even bring it up. Matter of fact, by the time the defense gets to cross-examine that witness, they will not have had the element of surprise, the aha moment. There's not going to be some Matlock moment with this witness. You're not going to walk up here and start pulling out things that I didn't know first and therefore brought out first, because I want this jury to know that I'm not hiding anything. I know every imperfection about this witness. I'm going to highlight it for you, but I still find that their testimony is believable and that you should believe them too. Yes, there are people, and I would tie it back to things we commonly know, right? We know people in our lives that are imperfect folks, but they don't lie about everything. They, you know, horrible about everything. They're horrible about some things, but not everything. And so we have to be able to discern that. In fact, as judges, we give an instruction and we tell jurors to rely on their common sense and reason. Some of the same things that they use in making determinations every single day in their lives, they don't check those at the door. They actually need to bring those same skills and tools with them when they're in those jury seats so that they can make decisions about credibility and, you know, likability, or whether or not something's reasonable, or, you know, because they are the triers of fact, not law. They determine what the facts are and they decide those facts using some of those very common sense basic tools that they've always had. And that's how I would treat them. And I would deny the defense an opportunity to do that. Now, that may mean, you know, if the prosecution doesn't, and they're too afraid of their own shadow and they don't want to bring in their lead detective to do that, then I toss the ball to you as the defense attorney and I say, what would you do?
And well, even if the prosecution called the witness and called the witness first and tried to mitigate, I would just keep harping on in cross-examination on the fact that he was fired for mishandling an investigation so seriously, and bringing it right back to this defendant, mishandling Karen Reed's investigation, mishandling the death of Officer John O'Keefe, mishandling evidence. You can infer a lot from his fact that he was fired over these degrading text messages. So I would try to do that. But also, the defense's theory of the case is that she was framed, that this was somehow an inside police officer deal, getting back for some reason at John O'Keefe, and that they needed a foil and she was the foil. So I would be harping on that. I would hope that the prosecution would not call Michael Proctor's witness. I don't see really how they can get by not doing it. But, you know, I would be salivating, hoping that they would not, because I would call him as a defense witness and what's called a hostile witness. And for our audience, you can say that a witness is totally against your client, totally against your client's point of view, is hostile to your theory of the case, and convince the judge, if the judge is convinced of that, and a lead investigating officer against the defendant, it would be pretty easy to convince the judge of that. Then the defense can ask leading questions during cross. They can basically cross-examine the witness instead of just asking direct questions. And that gives the defense the advantage of really framing the answers that they want in the form of the questions. And so if I were a defense attorney, I would love for the prosecution not to put him on. I can't believe that's going to happen.
You would probably be like, I can't believe they're not going to call him. I can't believe.
I want to move on to one other new witness, because on the witness list is a local blogger named Aidan, A-I-D-A-N, Kearney, K-E-A-R-N-E-Y. Make sure I'm pronouncing that correct. Aidan Kearney, known to his many thousands of followers as Turtle Boy. Turtle Boy took this on in case one as a cause celeb and really rallied the troops behind Karen Reed, was out there at the scene almost every day, was making speeches on the courthouse steps. He has been called, but the change of circumstance between trial one and trial two is that he has now been charged with witness intimidation, because he has just fomented so much against witnesses that they've been harassed, that they've been had their families harassed. You know, so he has been charged criminally. That wasn't the case in the first trial. He had no part of the first trial. Why would you bring him in as a prosecutor now?
Isn't that interesting? This is just kind of baffling. But I think I mentioned about this gentleman at the top of the episode.
Turtle Boy.
Not sure why somebody would go by that moniker, but okay. that said, this is one of the people who was really responsible for literally physically rallying the troops outside the courthouse, and was not just there sporadically, not there intermittently. It would seem to be every single day. This was becoming the, and had been the experience of this young man. And I'm not certain if I recall all of the facts surrounding the witness intimidation charges, except that what I think may have happened, at least from a perspective standpoint, is it may give more credence to that argument or that belief that this is a police setup and that the police are just working to quiet any opposition up to and including prosecuting anybody that would stand in their way of kind of, you know, clearing up this John O'Keefe murder with the conviction of Karen Reed. I don't know if the police view it that way. I'm not suggesting that I necessarily view it that way, but if I were a regular random person, maybe in the community, thinking, yeah, there may be some police involvement. If I was a conspiracy theorist, believing that there might be some police tentacles involved in this, I might perhaps perceive this as a form of retaliation by the police department to help quiet any interference, any support, or any meaningful support or defense to Karen Reed. And that's unfortunate, because one of the things that we try to do here, especially with our podcast, is helping to boost faith and trust in the system, encouraging people to trust and understand better what they don't know, so that, again, we can reinfuse it with trust. But sometimes, and I'm not suggesting that the arrest and charging of this man is without basis, I'm just saying that sometimes perception rules the day. And if that is the perception of what's happened, then sometimes the facts don't matter, right?
Well, in this case, one of the things that I failed to mention, just by omission, not by commission, is that Turtle Boy the prosecutors have received copies of texts between Turtle Boy and Karen Reed, where Karen Reed was supplying information to Turtle Boy to get him to amp him up even more during trial number one to raise this public outcry on her behalf. So I don't know what's in those text messages, but they have a series of text messages from her to him, providing him with information.
Which, again, can be problematic because not only could it be problematic for his prosecution or charges against him, but it could also be problematic for her as a defendant. So I guess my question to you in your, you know, if you were her defense attorney, what advice would you give her with regard to her communications, be it with him or even others? Because obviously there are ways to subpoena and to obtain text messages, even if you're on Signal, folks.
Yeah, I think that I would try to characterize it as desperation on her part. She was being bombarded with all of these charges, and the whole police force was against her, and they were manufacturing evidence. This is her point of view, and so her only outlet was to reach out to someone who was trying to talk to the general population. Yeah, that's how I would try to characterize it. I don't know that he's going to be a major factor. You know, whether he intimidated witnesses is his problem. But a witness did testify at the first trial that she and her family were intimidated by him. And that happened to be the same woman who did the Google search about how long does it take to die in the cold.
So she's prepared if somebody comes after her.
It makes it even more complicated.
It does. But I think as a defense attorney, would you not be concerned about how this might affect perception of your client at trial? I think I would counsel her to say, hey, listen, you know, don't communicate with this person, because the prosecution can get access to these text messages. And even if we can fight to keep them out of your trial, we could also lose that fight on, you know, some other grounds or for some other reason. And what we don't want is we don't want to mess with the algorithm of our strategy that could really turn out bad for you.
All right, two things in the last 10 minutes that we have that I want to talk about. And one is this HBO Max documentary, this 5-part documentary about the Karen Reed trial. And it pretty much focused on Karen Reed as the main person being interviewed, along with her legal team, along with some other people, reporters, and other people who added some commentary, but nobody from the prosecution office, nobody from the prosecutor's office at all. So that being the case, one, as an attorney, why would you do this? And two, do you think it has any kind of impact on maybe coloring a jury pool?
I think just about anything could color a jury pool.
It's a toughie, isn't it? You don't have this in any case.
But I definitely think that, especially with cases that get this type of attention, whether, you know, locally or nationally, remember George Floyd, right? And remember the concerns that we often had with whether or not there would be an objective pool of jurors for the Derek Chauvin trial. I think, again, there's that given the notoriety of this case and given how much attention this case has gotten, that you absolutely run the risk of it affecting and infecting the jury pool. So I don't know what the motivation behind that would be. What would you think? What do you
think? I think part of the motivation was, obviously, at the first trial, she did not testify. I doubt that she will testify at the second trial. I think it was a way to get her story out and her testimony out from a defense point of view without cross-examination, and to put it out in the public sphere,
yeah,
to show that she's being targeted and framed by this monolith called the Boston Police Department.
Yes, but also consider the fact that if you are in the process of selecting a jury, you're going to ask if anyone has seen or heard about this production. And more likely than not, you're going to be looking to exercise peremptories or just for cause challenges, not even peremptories, challenges for cause for anyone who's seen it. Maybe not someone who's merely heard of it, but certainly someone who's seen it or watched it, because of the concern that it is apparently or seemingly one-sided, and that it does or attempts to do exactly what you described and defined. And so that limits your jury pool, and it sends those people who otherwise would have been on the jury back outside on the street corners to just, you know, be vocal protesters. So that doesn't really net you anything.
What if it was to raise money for a defense? I mean, she obviously sold her story.
Lawyers aren't cheap. You are right.
It one, got her notoriety. Two, got her testimony out without being cross-examined. And three, I'm sure brought in money to her coffers to aid in the defense.
That sounds like the Alex Murdaugh case in South Carolina.
It does.
The clerk and Netflix, right? Signed the Netflix deal, which, you know, it's interesting because now we're kind of now, you know, moving to a conversation about the appetite that we as a society have for kind of getting this firsthand information on these very salacious cases. And the prices that are being paid for that, even if it at least appears to be at the expense of justice. That, I think, is, and mind you, now we're also talking about folks who are not governed by the same rules. As you notice, you know, you don't have the, and I think the clerk of courts in the Alex Murdaugh case may have been governed by some rules of ethics, but those rules aren't the same ones that govern judges or prosecutors or lawyers, who I think provide amazing perspective. I'm telling you, I think the perspective that judges can give you on cases that have happened or have passed would be an absolutely amazing effort. Are you listening, Max? Are you listening, Netflix? These could be amazing opportunities for you to gain some really important insight, especially when you can have judges talking to judges about some of these really, really intricate points. But I think instead they just settle for whatever they can get. And the path of least resistance is, you know, something like this, right? You've got a defendant who's protected and is counseled by attorneys. So they get their advice from there. And so that works out well. And they still get the story out because it's salacious. What I'll tell you is I think there's maybe some assumption that, oh, the judge's perspective might be boring or whatever. You'd be surprised at what judges say, think, and do when they're permitted to be more candid. But I think you're right. I think that part of it, you know, boils down to being able to continue to fund a defense at this level, to add attorneys, to not go under, and to be able to pivot to the next point and survive it all. That's not cheap. And yeah, if the story has value, if you're finding things in life that have value, i.e. your story, and somebody's willing to pay the price, you figure out how to get it there. Because remember, it's a win-win. It's a win for the defendant who wants your story out and is getting paid for it. But it's also a win for the attorney because your client's getting paid. So that means they can pay them.
Yeah. So a win-win, but it's so unusual to have this before a trial, even albeit a second trial, to, you know, this was the story of the investigation and the first trial. You know, it also breeds talk of a sequel, you know, as we get into the second trial, you know.
You know, we're used to it. But wait, there's more.
Exactly. But it's with our society's absolute desire for true crime stories, mm-hmm. you know, it feeds into that as well. I mean, this, you've got a 45-year-old fairly attractive woman being allegedly framed by the Boston Police Department to protect a murder that they conducted internally. Boy, that's pretty riveting stuff.
Yeah, I'd love to hear, again, an interview with the judge, an interview with the fired police officer, an interview with, you know, some of the other important witnesses, an interview with the prosecutor.
Didn't get that. Mr. Oatmeal didn't speak than in court.
These are, and again, even though he's Oatmeal, there's probably some additional perspective information or something that would have been just absolutely amazing to have known and to be aware of. And again, right. Since there's apparently no holds barred while you're, you know, going into a second trial and the matter still, you know, pending, it would have been maybe worth it to at least get that perspective and that information and compare it to the new strategy, the new streamlined strategy that now perhaps has, you know, thematic overlays and a through line or story to tell the jury that's not disjointed. That's, I think, pretty freaking interesting.
So we're recording this on Friday, April 4th. And as of this moment, 10 out of 16 jurors have been selected. Obviously, 12 to be on the jury and the others to be alternates to fill in case they lose jurors along the way. The whole jury selection process, I think, merits us at least touching on I should say hundreds of jurors have been brought in for this case. And part of the initial questions by the judge, obviously, is, have you heard about the case? Vast majority, yes. Have you formed an opinion about the case? Vast majority, less than a vast majority, but still a significant number, yes. You know, can you set that aside to listen to the evidence? A smaller number said yes. Talk about how a judge decides whether somebody can sit on a jury, given the high visibility of this in a very small community.
Well, and I think in these are just kind of circumstances we talked about before, right? Is, you know, the fact that you've got these daily protests that are taking place and you have folks that are involved in daily protests. Some are just committed to and consistent. And I think to your first question of, you know, asking jurors, hey, have you heard of this case? The answer is probably overwhelmingly yes, unless...
If they haven't, what rock are they been living in?
What is the address of the cave that you live in? Yeah. Because we just want to stop by and make sure you're okay over there, because you've clearly been living in one. And it's obvious that, you know, if you haven't even so much as heard about it and you're in that community or even like immediately neighboring communities, that, you know, something's awry. I'm amazed that there wasn't a motion filed to change the venue or to move the case someplace else because of the overwhelming presence from media and people from the immediate area and surrounding area. So as to help ensure that there would be an objective jury, remembering that the purpose and benefit of an objective jury is not just for the defense, but it is for the prosecution who represents the people as well. So there's a need for this, for both sides to feel that they have received a fair trial and that the scales of justice have not prematurely tilted one way or another to the benefit of one side or another before you even really get started. As a judge, I would absolutely be concerned in asking those questions, and I would be prepared to test those answers a little bit more, understanding that, yes, you know, there may be some who just really, really want to sit on the jury, and they may very well have formed opinions about the case, and they are just not prepared to share them for fear that they may be removed. But I think as a judge, you should be prepared to elicit those answers, even if they're, it's outside the hearing of some of the other jurors, but within the hearing of the prosecutor and the defense, so that, again, both sides are assured they're getting a fair trial. And to the extent that in testing some of those responses, the court is not satisfied that the defendant or that the prospective juror could be fair, objective, impartial until all of the evidence and information has come in, I think it's imperative that you invite them to be removed again so that the process is preserved for everybody. It is not about whether or not you can be a good juror. I think that judges say this all the time. We never doubt that somebody can be a good juror. You just may not be a good juror for this case, but you absolutely have the absolute right to be a juror. Just again, this may not be a good fit for you, and it's okay to test that.
Well, Judge, this is going to be a fascinating trial to watch, trial number two. So let's circle back to this as things pop up and keep track of it for our listeners, because I think it does bring up a lot of legal processes that you don't normally see in cases, and we can use it as a point of education.
I hope so, and I hope that the listeners for this particular episode found this to be a, you know, pretty fascinating a case as we did. I think that there's an awful lot that's going on. I wonder even if the Turtle Man's, you know, trial is somehow going to run kind of simultaneous to this one.
I don't know. Turtle Boy.
Yeah. If his case is going to run simultaneous to this one, or if the court is going to hold off on proceeding in it until this one's over. Who knows?
Who knows?
Or if it's even the same judge. There may be a different judge that it gets assigned to, and they don't have an obligation to wait.
Absolutely. Hey, how do people get a hold of us? How do they listen to us? And what do we want them to do?
We are so excited that you all decide to tune in and listen to us. So we're going to invite you to keep doing so. We're so honored to be a part of and affiliated with the NPR family. So we invite you to not just take a listen to us, but also subscribe. That way you get notification every time there's a new episode released. And make sure you like us as well and share us with some of your friends, your family, and those in your network. You can find us on NPR. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon. We are available wherever you get your favorite podcast. Just look for Next Witness, Please. We'll look forward to launching this and this episode, where you can also find all of our past episodes. So take a gander, take a listen, and check us out.
And if you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to us at my email address, which is hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. And if you have topics that you would like for us to cover in the future, shoot us an email at that address and we'll add your topic to our list. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and our audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.